The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go Beyond Reality.
Good evening, good morning, and welcome everyone. It's Beyond Reality Radio with Jason and JV, although Jason not with us tonight. I'm JV Johnson. Thanks for being here. We've got a returning guest tonight. It's going to be a very interesting discussion. We're going to be talking with Bernie Taylor. He's an author and a naturalist. We're going to be talking about the work he's been doing on redating, redefining, and re-exploring and rediscovering, maybe, the Great Sphinx. Speaking of social media, we'd like it if you'd go to beyondrealityradio.com and explore our website. Also, look us up on Facebook. It's just Beyond Reality Radio there. And stop by my personal fan page. It's JV Johnson on Facebook as well. So once again, tonight we're going to be talking about the Sphinx with Bernie Taylor. He's an author and a naturalist. He's got a book out, we've talked about it before, called Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. So we've got a lot to talk about tonight on the program, and I'm looking forward to a great discussion. We will take your phone calls a little bit later in the show at 844-687-7669. It's Beyond Reality Radio. Don't go away. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. We've got a great conversation lined up for us tonight. We've got returning guest Bernie Taylor. He's an author and a naturalist. His website is beforeorion.com, which references his book called Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. Bernie, welcome back to Beyond Reality Radio. It's great to have you here again.
JV, thanks for having me. I listened to in on the earlier segment of the program. It sounds great. And we're going to talk about the mainstream, the alternative, and the alternative to the alternative. This is a show that everybody doesn't want to, every podcaster doesn't want to stream. This is the controversy on the alternative itself. And we're going to come up with a new story, a new version of history that will just change the way you see humanity.
And so do I have to expect angry mail, Bernie? Is that what's going to happen here after our conversation? Because I welcome it if it does.
Well, I would say there's a few people that may have been on the show in the past that may not come back on again. But, you know, we're all moving forward, right? Remember,
yeah.
In the opening of the program, you can't handle the truth. I mean, are we ready to handle the truth? This is the big show. Taking off the gloves, and we're gonna dive right into it.
All right. Well, before we do that, I'm trying to remember when you were here last. It wasn't terribly long ago.
It was a few months ago. We did the why I don't believe hallucinogenic drugs have anything to do with consciousness, symbolic behavior, or paleolithic cave art.
Right, that's right.
And you're not going to have, he's never going to be on the program, is he?
So what have you been up to since you were on last?
So I've been doing more programs. I was at a lot of presentations. I was at UC San Diego last week, and I gave a presentation to planetary sciences and astrophysics. And we talked about this the paleolithic caves and the constellations and the images and how it all fit into the hero's journey. And everybody there asked the same question they ask everywhere else I've been, because we're trying to find that fundamental place from where we come from. So that's where I was last. And before that, I gave a presentation at a progressive Presbyterian church on Darwin Day. And I finally gave the same presentation and they asked the same questions, because we're all seeking the same answers. And some of those answers we're gonna explore tonight.
Yeah, now, of course, you know, there might be some folks who didn't get to hear our first discussions and where we actually broke down your book, Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. So why don't you take a few minutes here and just kind of lay that out for us so we have something to draw upon as we get into this conversation.
Absolutely, because it ties into some of these images we're going to talk tonight about the Great Sphinx. So there's a cave in the northern part of Spain near Bilbao in the Cantabria region. It's called an El Castillo cave system. And there's a panel in the cave called the Gallery of Discs. And this Gallery of Discs is about 33 feet across, 10 feet high, streams these red discs down the center from left to right, or right to left, either way. And what I was able to determine is that it's got about 30 or so characters that are animal and human beings. And the animal and human being characters are in the exact same order as the Greek constellations. So on one end, which is the north, we have Hercules, then we have Aegea, the eagle, we have Pegasus, the horse, we have the dolphin becomes Pisces, Cetus is the sea monster, which is the seal, we have Orion And then we have Cirrus as a dog. Above that, we have a Barbary ape, which is the Barbary ape is a Gemini. We have Ursa Major as bears, and of course bears. We have the great auk is the Cygnus. We have Draco, a crocodile becomes a dragon, and so forth. So we got a whole bunch of constellations, including the lion. The lion's a really important one. And so what's kind of critical about this panel is that we just don't see these characters like we see in other places. We see them in the exact same constellation order in the night sky as the Greeks depicted them in their record. And so someone could say, well, you know, you got a horse over there, and you got a bear over there, and, you know, you made all the constellations. That's not what this is. They're in the same order. And so there's no chance. I mean, it's the probability of many, many millions that they possibly, you know, there's no connection between the two. The Greeks had been to the cave, and Greeks and others, at this and other caves, and they walked out with astronomy from the distant past. It's the same astronomy that we use today. And these images are embedded in the wall. They're sort of hidden in there. And the red discs draw our attention to away from them. So it's a test. When I gave this test at UC San Diego last week, I started off, no one knew except the host what I was going to be presenting. And I gave it to him as a test. And, you know, I drew him in through red discs, and we talked about red discs and all these sort of things. Then I started throwing in these characters. And they're like, wait a second, where did that come from? But it's a psychological test to see if you can see the forest, the trees, or in this case, the animals in the savannah. And so that's where we start from. That's 34,000 years ago, okay? So Göbekli Tepe is maybe 12,000 years ago, Stonehenge, 4 to 5. You know, the Giza pyramids, 4,500 years ago. So we're talking tens of thousands of years before everything else that we have a record of, that we can actually draw a story from, or draw the constellations from. This is how far back in time we're going.
Yeah, so I understand. And again, we had this conversation, but I like to refresh my mind and the mind of the listeners. You're saying that this cave art was there, and at some point, Greek travelers visited the cave, and they used those images as the references that we now use for our modern astronomy?
Absolutely. So it was the Greek Claudius Ptolemy who put together the Almagest, and that is the source book of modern astronomy. And Ptolemy, he was questioned that he, actually in modern times people say he's a fraud. They say he's a fraud because he marked down constellations that he couldn't have seen in his time. And the reason is because the Earth wobbles like a top, spinning top, and constellations dip below and above the horizon over long periods of time. And he saw things. He chronicled things he couldn't have seen. And so modern astronomers said, this guy's a fraud. But perhaps the biggest fraud in history, but they never knew how he did it. But now we can see how he did it because he had been to the caves. But the Phoenicians had been there, the Greeks, the Romans, and I would argue the Egyptians too, which is the ancient Egypt is the holy grail to alternative history. So John Anthony West was, you know, 30 or so years ago, he looked at the Great Sphinx and he said, this is older than, he walked away, this is older than conventional Egyptologists say. He hooked up with Robert Schock. And that's where we start our story, and with the dating by Robert Schock.
Your website is beforeorion.com. Is the information we're going to be talking to about tonight also on the website?
Absolutely. So there's a 2-minute video that chronicles the images that we're going to explore today.
Our phone number is 844-687-7669. We'll take your calls later in the show. We are talking with Bernie Taylor tonight, author and naturalist. His website is beforeorion.com. His book is also called Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. Tonight we're talking about the Sphinx. And let's start here, Bernie, by kind of outlining the traditional wisdom. What were we told about the history of the Sphinx as we were going through, let's say, grade school or whatever it happened to be?
Absolutely. So the great mainstream archaeologists say that the Great Sphinx was a mound, a limestone mound. And that it was roughly geologically formed, so the outer walls of this kind of enclosure, as well as the fundamental body and head. And then they say they believe that ancient Egyptians, they carved out the face to be similar to somebody, maybe, or Pharaoh. They don't really know. And that they carved out the body in some places where they could make it look like the body of a lion, and they reinforced other sections. And they believe that the Great Sphinx is roughly about the time period of the pyramids at Giza. And that the face makes sense because there's very little weathering on the face, or at least the weathering is similar to that of the Egyptian pyramids at Giza. And so Robert Schock comes along at the invitation of John Anthony West. And Schock's work is really a criticism of the Egyptologist. He doesn't actually come up with an answer, and I'm going to explain that. So Schock said that if you look at the outer walls of this chamber that the Sphinx kind of indentation it sits in, there's horizontal and there's vertical patterns. And he says that the vertical weather patterns came from a time of intense rain, and the rain was kind of seeping over, coming over edges, seeping down to the cracks. And he believed it happened during a very wet period, which had to be prior to 6,000 or 7,000 years ago. And prior to that time, the greater Egyptian area, at least like all of North Africa, was more humid, and there are huge lakes the size of the Great Lakes of the United States. And so there's a lot of water and monsoon rains and all that sort of stuff. And so he said, originally came in and says, got to be more than 6,000 years old. He then pushed it back to about 8,000, and now he's at about 12,000 years old goal, which directly aligns with Atlantis because he's an Edgar Cayce fan. And so he's on Team Atlantis, and it all the stars align, and that's his story. Now, there's other geologists. So people in alternative worlds say, well, Schock's a geologist. He knows better, so on and so forth. Well, that's not exactly true because other geologists have a different story. A pair of Ukrainian geologists wrote a paper, and it's a geological aspect of the problem of dating the Great Egyptian Sphinx. And what they say is that the vertical weather patterns are actually from water, and it's like ocean type of tidal water. And they say it's at least 800 years that formation of that outer chamber or that wall is at least 800,000 years ago because that's the type of weathering you could find from that pattern.
Did you say 800,000 years ago?
800,000 years ago, exactly. So you can pick your geologist. And they're saying, so what they're saying is that 800,000 years ago, there was water elements pushing against that inside the enclosure of the Sphinx, which created that formation. So if you pick your geologist between 800,000 years ago and now Schock with his, Atlantis 12,000 years ago. And so if 800,000 years ago, you could have had this weathering pattern by water, by sort of tidal water, between 800,000 and, 400,000, you could have had the vertical patterns coming, the seeping that Schock says is 12,000. And that's really important. You can actually go back millions of years in the greater Egyptian region inland, and there's in Wadi El Hiltan, there's fossils of whales. And so the Giza pyramid is in a very lowland flat area, and that whole section, the Giza delta, is fundamentally it's flat. And historically, water had come up, and there had been shallow seas that even took whales and sharks and other animals. And so we can't really look at if it's a geological primary geological formation. Everything fundamentally except the head of the Sphinx, we have to look at geologically, and we have to look at the big picture, and we have to, not in terms of Atlantis or these other things. So that's the geological story of the Great Sphinx. And the mainstream archaeologists probably aren't that far off. But there's another story that came out. And have you had Robert? Sorry.
Yeah, I just want to, before you get into the other story, I want to ask about everybody can essentially picture the Sphinx in their head. I mean, I'm sure at some point or another, we've all seen a picture of it, talked about it, whatever it happens to be. These weathering patterns that you're talking about, these water erosion patterns mm-hmm. that you're speaking of, where exactly would we find those? Are they on the Sphinx itself, or are they?
They're actually on. If the Sphinx sits in like an indentation, kind of a walled indentation, and they're on they're on the walls of that indentation.
Okay, so on it's not on the Sphinx itself.
It's not on the Sphinx itself.
Okay,
correct.
Okay, I understand. But we're assuming, or we've determined that the Sphinx itself and those walls come from the same time.
Correct. And okay. So the ancient Egyptians had many times over kind of fixed up the walls, or it's not the walls, the body of the Sphinx. And they recarved it, they added blocks. And so it's very difficult to tell by looking at the actual Sphinx what the date of it is. And so that's why they look at the walls of the so-called outer chamber.
Okay, now it's starting to make a little bit more sense to me from a visual perspective. Okay, so we have these different theories, and we've got these different discussions going on, and you said we've got something else to bring to the table.
And so the other one is Robert Bovall. And everybody, all you listeners have seen Ancient Aliens and other programs and seen this Orion Constellation Theory that includes the three main pyramids. Remember, there's more than three pyramids on the Giza Plateau because it's three plus six others, but they don't seem to have fallen to the theory. Anyway, the three major pyramids plus the Sphinx somehow align to the exact same time in the night sky as Atlantis 12,000 years ago, or Plato's Atlantis 12,000 years ago. And the story's over because it's all proven and all this sort of stuff. And because that's what timing to the vernal equinox, because everybody times their constellations of the vernal equinox according to Bovall and Hancock. And it all the stars align at that time. And so Schock has wrote co-authored the book with Bovall, and they synchronize their theories to have to be on Team Atlantis together. And Schock is out there doing Atlantis tours. You can get him on the program. He can tell you all about Edgar Cayce and the vision and all that sort of stuff. And so we have another story out there. There's a fellow, an Italian named Armando Maid. You can get him on the program. Armando said that Bovall isn't really that far off. He's just looking at a wrong time period. And Armando Maid says that it was 36,000 years ago, because that's when Leo the lion in the shape and the form of the Sphinx was actually correctly aligned with the other figures on the pyramid at the Giza complex. So Armando May wrote a book called Ancient Mysteries. And he actually recently, after reviewing my work, he changed his event. And I wrote the afterword to his book to explain the updates and what has been found based on my work. And he's going forward in my direction. He's modified what he's doing. So how did he come up with 36,000 years ago in addition to the whole thing aligning? There are two lists of kings. And these lists of kings are let's call the ancient pharaohs further back in time. And they both go to about 36,000 years ago. And the question has always been asked, well, are these real or not? John Anthony West said they were real. And John Anthony West believed that the origin of the Sphinx, maybe not the actual construction of the Sphinx or the carving, he believed it was back to 36,000 years ago. And so he was not on Team Atlantis. And so Armando May kind of borrowed some of Val's ideas, borrowed some of Jonathan West's ideas, and he came out with this phenomenal book, Ancient Mysteries. And it's out there. It's in multiple languages around the world and off Amazon and all that sort of stuff. So we have multiple theories about the Great Sphinx. And they all have these different timings, but each one of their timings coordinates to some other artifact. So whether it be Atlantis, whether it be the list of the kings, whether it be the 800,000 years ago when that was a tidal area. No one has been able to actually date the origin of the Sphinx. What they're doing is they're trying to date other things and then coordinating or collaborating those with the Sphinx. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Now, let me just ask a couple of what might be naive questions here. If it was built 800,000 years ago.
Well, it wasn't built. So geologically, the fundamental structure before it was carved would have been formed 800,000 years
ago. I see. Okay. So that could have been just a big, big rock.
Fundamentally,
what we're saying,
exactly. And if in that part of the, you can look at images in that part of the desert. There's a lot of these type of objects out there. I live in Oregon near the coast, and I can see these sort of things on the coast where they're weathered down by both the wind, the ocean, and rainfall. So this is not unique at all. And so the question is, okay, we're going back to, which geologist do you believe? Which astronomer do you believe? And which Egyptian records do you believe? Because they're all different. And that has historically been the problem with dating the Great Sphinx.
We're talking with Bernie Taylor. We're talking about the Great Sphinx. And Bernie, we've got about, let's see, we've got about 6 minutes here. Is that enough time to get into the next part of this story?
Let's do it. Yes,
yeah,
six minutes.
All right, let's go.
So we're going to go back to, about 20 minutes. We talked about this gallery of discs, and we had all these animals, including the lion, and that the lion, the crouching lion, is the constellation Leo. And it's a summer solstice time period, because some of the animals, there's a juvenile kitten lynx pressing against the mother's ruff. There's a fledgling golden eagle that hasn't flown yet, mid-June time period. You get a few different animals. So it's telling us that this scene that we're looking at here is a summer solstice image, okay? That all these constellations as they serve at that time of the year. Now, this lion is superimposed over it with this large carnivore. And this sitting carnivore has the head. It's missing the nose, just like the Great Sphinx. It has that teardrop shape on its forehead, just like the Great Sphinx. But most importantly, it has the Nemi's headdress. Okay? Mm. So, which was a symbol of pharaonic power that was worn in ancient Egypt by the rulers. And so we have this large carnivore with this Nemi's headdress superimposed over the Great Sphinx. And the head of this carnivore is much smaller than, of course, to the body of this huge lion, which is fundamentally 10 meters across, which is exactly as the head of the Great Sphinx is relative in size to the body of the being. Okay, so what the Egyptians did is they copied from something else, Egyptians, okay, that they copied from somebody else who had this smaller head on top of the larger lion's body. And we find the same representation in this gallery of discs, this panel in Spain from 34,000 years ago. It's a therianthrope. And there's lots of therianthropes on that panel. There's a man who merges with a horse to become a centaur. There's a horse that merges with the eagle to become the Pegasus. There's a man who merges with a dolphin to become a merman. And so in the Paleolithic cave art, or in the mind of the animist, you merge with the animals to draw strength from it. So in the case of the Great Sphinx at Giza, it's a therianthrope, where this ruler, or depiction of the ruler, is drawing strength from the lion. And that's the fundamental story. Now, before we jump, we have about a minute left.
We've got about 2 minutes left, then we have our top of the hour break, then we've got a good segment on the other side.
Okay, what's a little slightly about ancient Egypt? Ancient Egyptians did not celebrate, their big holiday was not the vernal equinox, as Bouval, Hancock, and Schock are saying, with their whole Orion constellation timing and all that sort of stuff they got going on there. Their big time of year was the summer solstice. That's when that was the new year. It's when they restarted the calendar, but it was also the inundation of the Nile. The Nile actually flooded that time and went right up to the feet of the Sphinx, of the Great Sphinx at Giza. So this concept that you have to, everything has to be timed to the vernal equinox is garbage, because the ancient Egyptians didn't do it. Now, there's something else about the ancient Egyptians. The dynastic Egyptians didn't have the constellation Leo. So how did they come up with this huge Giza complex with Leo tied to the vernal equinox and all the belt of Orion, all this sort of stuff, when they didn't even have Leo as a constellation in their record? Not until about 2,000 years ago it pops up, and I think it's called the Deneb disk. But so at the time that the Egyptian pyramids were made, or in even earlier time among the Egyptians, they didn't have Leo as a constellation. So we've got a lot of questions out there. Number one question is, where did they get Leo from? If the Sphinx is Leo in the Paleolithic record, how did it get there? Number two is, we've got a whole new timing. How could we have walked down this road of the Orion constellation theory and, you know, Atlantis and all these other fabrications that are pretty much mainstream on the History Channel right now, and that people believe? I give presentations and people will say, well, what about Leo and the Great Sphinx and the Orion constellation theory? Doesn't this all work out with the Paleolithic cave image? I say, no, it doesn't. It doesn't even work out with ancient Egyptians. And there's the criticism of those ideas have been just like buried by the program, the big program on the History Channel. And so there's the group think is about what's been poured on us rather than what we've the information we've been able to give to objectively evaluate what the story is. Because what people say is, well, if it comes from mainstream archaeologists, a mainstream Egyptologist, and they disagree with us, they're lying. They're holding a truth from us, and they're the evil ones. You know, they're the bad ones. But it's not that way all the time. It's actually probably not way most of them. They're searching for the same answers we are. They're just taking a little slower. They're not jumping to take constellations in the night sky, throw them onto the pyramids, and say we're all done. Let's sell books.
Yeah. And if it was that obvious, everybody would get to the answer very quickly. It's certainly not obvious in any way. So we do have a lot of this is open to interpretation. All right. We have to go to break here. This is our top of the hour break. And we're going to come back with more with Bernie Taylor. We'll also take your phone calls at 844-687-7669. We're talking about the dating of the Great Sphinx in Egypt. It's a fascinating conversation. It also ties to Bernie's book. It's called Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. A lot more to come. It's Beyond Reality Radio. I'm JV Johnson. Thanks for being here. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. We've got a great show for you tonight, talking with Bernie Taylor, a returning guest to the show. He's an author and a naturalist. His book is called Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. You can find out more information about his work and the book at beforeorion.com. I had mentioned in the last hour the passing of Dan Blankenship. Those who watch the reality series The Curse of Oak Island on History Channel know exactly who I'm talking about. He's a veteran treasure hunter who in 1965 read a Reader's Digest story about the mystery of the Oak Island treasure. A lot of people read that Reader's Digest story and became infatuated with the hunt for that treasure. Dan acted on it, and in 1970 became a full-time treasure hunter and has lived on Oak Island ever since. So what does that put us at? 49 years, nearly 50 years. He passed away on Sunday at the age of 95 years old. And more work has been done in the last few years because of the work of the Lagina brothers, who are featured on the television show The Curse of Oak Island. And they've gotten closer to than ever before, than anyone else has, to determining what, if anything, is hidden on Oak Island. Well, Dan passed away. He won't be able to see the resolution of that effort. I will say this one thing, though, because it's kind of circulating on chat rooms and blogs and stuff, that the curse itself that has been talked about on the program is that six people have died in the effort to find the treasure. And it wouldn't be until the seventh person died that the treasure would be found. And if you believe such things, I guess Dan Blankenship would be that seventh person. I don't know if I believe that, but it's an interesting perspective. Anyway, our best to the Blankenship family. He lived a long, healthy, good, full life, 95 years, but it's never easy to lose a loved one. So our best to the Blankenship family and all those who are involved in the TV show The Curse of Oak Island, because I know they were a tight-knit family. We're going to be taking your phone calls as well here. Again, our guest, Bernie Taylor, tonight. We're talking about the mystery of the Sphinx. And, Bernie, one of the things that we often hear when we talk about the Sphinx, it's kind of goes hand in hand to say the riddle of the Sphinx. What exactly is the riddle part of this? Is it what we're talking about tonight?
Well, the riddle of the Sphinx, there are multiple Sphinxes, and tonight we're talking about the Giza Sphinx, but we can actually segment off into the Greek Sphinx, because the Greeks told the story of Oedipus, the famous Oedipus, and he approached the Sphinx, and the Sphinx asked him the question of what begins life on four legs, then two, then three, and the answer is it's the man that starts as a child, walks on 2 feet, then ultimately 3 feet with a cane. And so the concept of the Sphinx is not purely Egyptian, because independently we have the sitting Sphinx among the ancient Greeks. And in this gallery, this image from Spain 34,000 years ago, we have the crouching lion with the Sphinx superimposed over it, and we have the sitting Sphinx, the large carnivore. So we have actually both images to account for two different places. Why all Sphinx don't look the same. And the answer, so that the answer to the your question is that there are multiple sphinxes, and if you look at this image, you could actually walk away with, you know, could be two. And so that's but it's a therianthrope. Truly, it's a therianthrope, which is the combination of human and animal characteristics, and that's really the essence of the Sphinx itself.
Right.
It's not a monster. It's not a monster per se. On the hero's journey, he encounters the lion, and he draws strength from the lion.
Before we get into and more of that, I do want to take a listener call here or two. This is Jim in South Carolina. Jim, welcome to the program. Thanks for holding on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Have you ever heard of the Temple of the Birds?
Give me a location.
Well, if you place Cygnus the Swan over top of the pyramids, and where the Neb sits is the Temple of the Swans. An Englishman about 10 or 12 years ago discovered a archaeologist from the 1800s had found a cavern up underneath this one temple that had birds stuffed in it at the doorway of the two ibises. But anyway, he sent a man and wife team to Egypt over there to identify it. Have you heard of this?
So was the author of the modern book, The Cygnus Mystery, by Andrew Collins?
I believe it may have been. It's a man and wife team.
Okay, so Andrew Collins, smart guy, okay? He's written a bunch of interesting books. They're all about Cygnus, and he sees everything as everything, fundamentally anything is Cygnus, okay? You get him on the program, he'll talk about Cygnus, okay? But here's why Andrew Collins' work is important, because he actually lined up the pyramids, the three Giza pyramids, major pyramids, to Cygnus.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking. And there's a cavern that goes about 300 feet up underneath the plateau.
Okay, so here's the question.
Opening.
So I'm going to give you a question. So Andrew Collins came up with the pyramid, three major pyramids being Cygnus, and Bouval comes up and being the belt of Orion, and Shock saying it's 12,000 years ago, and the geologist saying 800,000 years ago. You realize how many different stories? It's like, you know, everybody's got an Atlantis. Well, I'd say, give me 10 Atlantises that you are positively sure are the one, and then we'll have a serious conversation. That's how ridiculous it is, because everybody.
I think you measure the three pyramids. The third one's slightly off.
Correct.
And it measures up more with the middle of the stars in Cygnus than it does with Orion.
And that's what Collins said. That's what Collins said exactly. So what we have a unique opportunity in history now is we actually have the teacher's edition book to the Egyptology, okay, and the Greeks and the Romans and Phoenicians, and we can see where it came from. And the bird, there's actually two birds in that area of the night sky on this Paleolithic cave. One is the great auk. One's a great auk, and the other one is an ostrich. You know what an ostrich looks like if you cut off its eggs, its legs? Picture it. It's like a swan.
Yeah.
I suppose, yes.
And so you have an ostrich and the great auk. And so what the Greeks, the original, based on the constellations as they appear, the original Cygnus was the great auk. However, the ostrich is up there. And so it was another constellation in the night sky that the Paleolithic artists had recognized. So I can't say what it was, but so the whole story, Andrew Collins, he talks about the cosmic egg and the birth of the universe, all that sort of stuff. Well, the great auk actually, he has the cosmic egg, and we can see that the cosmic egg is a great auk egg, and we have this character who holds the actual egg. And so in the Paleolithic version, the great auk was a major character. The ostrich was a lesser character. We just don't know what it was. But I believe that the ancient Greeks saw the ostrich, and they cut off the legs and made it a swan. But it still wouldn't exactly be the constellation Cygnus because it's off by a bunch of degrees in the night sky. But that's a good point, because what you just brought up is another interpretation of the Giza pyramids.
Jim, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, we appreciate you joining the conversation. The number's 844-687-7669. I have another naive question here, and then we've got to jump to our next break.
There are no naive questions.
This one's a bit naive, and I should know some of these answers. Now, are there any caverns or chambers associated with the Sphinx itself, or are those reserved to the pyramids?
Well, it's actually behind, let's call it behind the butt of the Sphinx, there is a temple. And I've seen pictures from the outside. I've never been to the Great Sphinx, but you can see pictures from the outside, and it's called like the Sphinx Temple or something like that. So the answer is yes. Now, on the vision of Edgar Cayce in a dream said that there was a chamber below the right paw of the Sphinx and below, and all the answers to the universe would be solved if you could go into that chamber. And so with the help of the Edgar Cayce Society, they did some, you know, some sort of seismic dating. I don't know. Actually, not dating. Evaluation to find out the hole. And they start drilling down towards this alleged subterranean chamber. And all at the verge of getting there, I mean, they were so close, the evil Egyptologists stopped the project. Okay. Can you imagine this now? Now, if I said to you, if I had a dream – Edgar Cayce had a dream and said, below your kitchen, there is a chamber that will give you all the secrets of the universe. Does that give me the right to start, you know, drilling in your kitchen floor? Should be a no.
Yeah, I'd say no.
Okay. And that's the equivalent of this thing, okay? And so this started from the Edgar Cayce dream, and he says the Egyptologists were against him because they wouldn't let him. They would reach that point because they were so close. And, you know, if you didn't, it's not there. Okay. It just isn't there. So anyway, are there chambers below? You know, there's probably a lot of cavities throughout that whole region in the ground, but it doesn't mean that the secrets of the universe are there. And Edgar Cayce, and this actually totally debunks Edgar Cayce, because if Edgar Cayce could actually have seen any of this stuff, he would have seen in his dreams or his visions the caves where you find this Sphinx on the wall.
Right.
I mean, it just – so I'm not out to debunk Edgar Cayce because I think the whole thing is actually nonsense. But if anybody out there is an Edgar Cayce believer, you know, this was the nail in the coffin if you didn't, you know, get it before.
His website is beforeorion.com. His book is Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. Bernie, how long ago did you write the book?
So I completed it about a year and a half ago, and it probably took me maybe 3 years to actually do the work. And it followed a previous book, Biological Time, which was How Plants and Animals Are Time and Knowledge by Indigenous Hunter-Gatherers and Ancient Peoples. And that was about 14 years ago. And I kind of asked the questions of why do salmon run earlier or later, and do they follow one smart fish, or there's some sort of timing mechanism. I looked at the Native American calendars. And then I went back in time and said, you know, maybe someone knew this in the distant past, and that drew me to the cave images in Europe, Paleolithic Europe, 17,000 years ago at Lascaux. And I started to evaluate the biological time and context within that of the Paleolithic cave artists. And lo and behold, they had the exact same nomenclatures as the Native Americans, which tied to the biological clocks or when you'd go hunting and fishing for these animals, which all made sense because the animals haven't changed in 17,000 years. And that took me – when I started working on – when I finished that, I said I'm kind of ahead of my time. And I gave scientific presentations and conferences and universities and endocrinology and all these different areas. And I said I'm going to put this on the shelf for 10 years and I'm going to come back. When I came back 10 years later, there had been new dating of – or older dating of the Paleolithic cave images. And the El Castillo cave was dated at 40,000 years ago, which became the oldest cave art in the world dated at that time. And that was super important because then we could push the limits on how far back in time people would have known this. And I I started counting the discs, doing just like I did with the other cave images with tied to the animal timing. And as I started to do that, I said, well, you know, it might be more something more here. And I looked and I saw that I started looking outside the disc and I saw the elephant and the lion and I saw a bunch of human characters. I said, oh, my God, that millions of people had seen this, but they hadn't seen this. And I quickly recognized the reason was these red discs are kind of they draw you in like a red stop sign, a red lipstick or McDonald's sign with the red and DQ and Burger King. And of course, the outer lines of like a Time magazine, because it draws us at a most basic level to the red disc. And I recognize that's why people hadn't seen it. And that's OK. But we're all past that now. And so how did I get into this was through the biological time work, which then took me on my own hero's journey by going through these cave images and kind of like rethinking who I am and who is humanity and where do we get our information from? In this case here, the ancient Egyptians had borrowed. So we believe that we actually, let's say a few years ago, we believe that the ancient Egyptians were at kind of the pinnacle of ancient civilization for their time and that everything they created was new. And of course, Jonathan West and Graham Hancock and others, they said, no, it came from someplace else, but they had no place that it came from. Göbekli Tepe ultimately was unearthed maybe 20 years ago and came popular in the last 6 years, which pushed it back to that there was early civilizations, 12,000 years, but there was no relationship between the art and the archaeology at Göbekli Tepe and the ancient Egyptians. So yes, there was an early megalithic Göbekli Tepe, but it's not connected to the ancient Egyptians. And it's pretty obvious because the symbology is completely different. But what the ancient Egyptian symbology is directly related to is this Paleolithic cave image at El Castillo.
Tomorrow night, we've got Heather Ash Amara on the show. She's an author talking about her book, A Little Book on Big Freedom. And then Wednesday night, Tanya Richardson, who is an intuitive, will be here to talk about her new book called Angel Intuition, A Psychic's Guide to the Language of Angels. And she'll help us learn how to improve our intuition. And we'll talk about your sixth sense and how you can receive more divine guidance to improve every aspect of your life. And then Thursday, Dr. Bruce Solheim is a returning guest. He's also a distinguished professor of history, an author, and a psychic medium. He's got a new book in his series called Timeless Deja Vu, A Paranormal Personal History. And this book provides 31 more true personal experiences of the paranormal, such as ghosts, telepathy, out-of-body experiences, and much more. That'll be Thursday night's program. Tonight, we are talking with Bernie Taylor. Bernie is an author and a naturalist, also a returning guest to the program. His website is beforeorion.com. And his book is called Before Orion, Finding the Face of the Hero. We've been talking about the Sphinx all night. You've told us about several different theories about dating the Sphinx, and you've connected the concepts and the ideas to the cave in Spain, and that's been the focus of your book and your study. So once again, just bringing this back around to the date ideas, why are the dates so important here?
Well, the El Castillo cave dating is 34,000 years ago. So the ancient, we're going to call them the ancient Egyptians, had been to the caves. They took this image, and they, in their own time, could have carved out the face of the Sphinx, the head of the Sphinx, and fixed up the body. And the enclosure area, which has that weathering, both the horizontal and the vertical, could have been from some time hundreds of thousands of years ago. So here's a problem, though, okay? And I haven't solved this one out. So I said earlier that the ancient Egyptians did not have the constellation Leo, at least not in early dynastic times. But they clearly have the Sphinx oriented towards the east, and they drew it from this Paleolithic image where, in fact, it's towards the east as well. So was it the ancient Egyptians who first designated that monument as the constellation Leo for the Sphinx? I don't think so. There was somebody else. Because if it was the ancient Egyptians, we would have seen earlier, we would actually see in the record the Leo as a constellation, but we don't see it until about 2,000 years ago during Greco-Roman times. So there was some other influence that came into the ancient Egyptians. And I believe it was somewhere around dynastic times or pre-dynastic times. So we're talking between, 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, not 12,000 years ago, Atlantis. Okay. So there was somebody, ancient Egypt was a crossroads of civilizations. And as these great lakes in the Great Sahara dried up, people migrated into the Nile Delta and they migrated through the Nile Delta. So you had a mix of cultures. And one of those cultures, I believe, are the ones who carved out the first great Sphinx. And then later Egyptian pharaohs cleaned it up. They dug it out further, improved, here and there. But I believe that it wasn't the ancient Egyptians who first designated that great Sphinx. It was someone who had been to the caves in Spain, but who it was, we don't know. And later in time, the Egyptians had sphinxes, of course, much smaller sphinxes, and they were modeled after the great Sphinx at Giza. And so there's still a mystery out there of who, in fact, made the great Sphinx. But the mystery of the origin of the great Sphinx, we can now kind of put the rest that it goes back to 34,000 years ago. There's also another question that I actually address in the book, but I don't address on the podcast or the radio programs, is what is the origin of this El Castillo panel? Because the Paleolithic cave artists didn't come up with one or two or three artists this entire body of constellations.
Right.
It just didn't happen. And this elaborate mythology with the cosmic egg and the hero on his journey and all these sort of things, that there's an origin to that. And I talk about in the last chapter of my book, but maybe we can have another show about it. But there is an origin to this El Castillo cave panel that dates back much further in time. And it's not in Spain. And it's not in Egypt. So that's out there for your crew to wrap its head around for another show someday, right?
Absolutely. Let's take another listener call here before we run out of time. This is TJ in Rhode Island. Hey, TJ, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
And I have a question for Bernie, because I noticed this fascinates me, because many of these types of investigations usually involve the traditional, what I would at least call Eurocentric positioning. And how does it compare, if you've done any, or do you plan on doing comparison, say with Chinese prehistory civilization, because they have that unique view that they do not thank the West for their culture. They take no credit for a time. They also have their own mythology, where they place Panku, the first man, millions of years ago as being living on the earth?
Good question. I lived in China in my early 20s, and I'm 54 now. And I remember I was on the bus once with a Chinese person on one side and an Italian on the other. And the Italian said that Marco Polo brought the spaghetti, a pasta, to China. China said that Marco Polo stole it from China and brought it back to Italy. It's a true story. And it really goes back to where – so Pongo is actually a really good story. Pongo is about the creation of the universe, the cosmic egg, that singularity. And Pongo wakes from the cosmic egg, and through his axe he splits in two, makes the yin and the yang. And Pongo the constellations splay out into the night sky, and Pongo himself becomes – his head becomes the mountain, and his body become the trees, all these sort of things, which is fundamentally the same story. It also holds up the earth. He holds up the sky during that time period too, which is fundamentally the story of the Titan Atlas. Okay.
Yeah.
And so the answer to your question is that there is a monomyth. There's a story deeper in time, and we find this Pongo character fundamentally in this Paleolithic cave image. And so going back, the Chinese civilization doesn't go back 34,000 years ago, but we can find the origin of their myths in this place as well. There's an interesting constellation among the Chinese, is they designate the star Sirius as a dog. Well, so did the Greeks, and so did Native Americans as people in North Africa. So why do people all around the world designate Sirius as a dog when it doesn't look like a dog? Because they come from a common origin. And so I think that is the tie that connects people around the world. But Pongo is a very good one that you brought up, that yes, there was that singularity, there was that cosmic egg, and there was the hero that broke from this egg, from the egg. And that story is on the Nordic, the Orphic Greeks, it's told among the ancient Egyptians, the Dogon. It's like, and we see it in this Paleolithic cave, we see the cosmic egg, and all the constellations just break free into the night sky in the Big Bang.
Well, that's what fascinates me about it, is the fact that it is dated so far back in history relative to what you usually see in the Middle East or in the others, because it goes back millions and millions of years in their time frame.
You mean the Chinese?
Yeah. I mean, they don't have this, you know, say the traditional Judaic 5,000 years ago, the earth was formed type thing. This goes back much further, which leads to more interesting questions, I think.
Well, interesting. You know, I grew up in the New York area, and I had a lot of Jewish friends, and Jewish friends used to tell a joke that, you know, the Chinese civilization only goes back 4,000, but the Jews go back 5. What did we eat for 1,000 years?
Okay. Right on that. Okay. At least a happy note. I'll let you go, and I appreciate the time.
So TJ, thank you.
Chinese go 4,000, yeah.
Yeah, TJ, thank you for the phone call. We appreciate you. Always have great questions.
That was a clean joke, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was perfectly fine. In today's day and age, I'm never sure, but I think that one was fine. We only have a couple minutes left with you here, Bernie. What are you working on next?
So what I'd like to be – well, I love doing podcasts, and I love – I do a lot of mini documentaries, called 2 minutes, right? I put them on YouTube and then my webpage, BoreOrion.com. But clearly the next stage for me is to become part of like a Netflix documentary or a Travel Channel or something like that. So if someone out there is listening and you're in the Hollywood or the Bollywood scene, you know, let's talk and connect with me. And because this is a visual, it's incredible, and it tells a story that nobody else is telling, but it is the story everybody else tells, because it's the core of all the stories. So we can talk about myth and monsters. We can talk about astronomy. We can talk about the cosmic egg. And all these great myths that, you know, we find around the world. So that is the target for the next one. And I'm still giving presentations. So if you're on the West Coast in some sort of organization, so I'll go to universities and colleges as well as churches, progressive churches. And I've done presentations at high schools. And so I love getting out there, giving the talk, and testing people live. And you can see their expressions, their faces, like, oh, my God, how did we miss that? And then every slide, they're challenged again because they missed it again. And so it's a lot of fun and continuing the journey. End of my journey, hero's journey, is to tell the story, share what I learned.
And I had one more question occurred to me here about the work you've done studying the cave art. You keep mentioning the red discs, which are very, very apparent when you look at the photographs. And you talk about those discs actually diverting your eye from the bigger picture, if you will, and these things you're talking about. Were those red discs added at a different time? Or
no, same time.
They were.
And we're dating the panel through the red discs. The panel is limestone, and calcium carbonate secretes from the limestone. And when it goes over, let's say, the red discs as actual man-made art, we can say that if we can date the calcium carbonate, then we have to say that red disc must be at least as old as that calcium carbonate. It might be a day older. It could be a million years older. Okay. And so if you take a bunch of red discs and you can date the calcium carbonate over them, and they're all within a few thousand years, you can probably say, you know, this is probably, it's not a million years old. It's probably 1,000 years or so older. And so that's how they're dated by the red discs. That's pivotal.
Got it. Got it. Okay.
Because no one saw anything else. So that's because no one had seen anything in modern times. No one had seen anything besides the red disc. But now you could actually go look at the calcium carbonate over many characters in it to see what more common dating, which was not expected when they did the original red disc studies.
And to take a page out of TJ's question, do Central American cultures share some of these ideas as well?
Good question. So the answer is the more fundamental ones, such as the cosmic mountain, the pyramids in Egypt have fundamentally the same structure as the Mayan so-called pyramids.
Right.
And they're in flat areas where there are no mountains. So I would say that the the man-made pyramids and, you know, the steeples and the churches, they are the connection between the earth and the sky world. In the same way as the mountain is Mount Everest and Olympians were on Mount Olympus, and Hercules climbed Mount Atlas, now Jebel-Towakal. Around the world, we find these cosmic mountains. And when we find either the temple on top of the mountain, or if it's too flat where there's no mountains, we find a temple that was made in its place. So these fundamental archetypes, the avianoid, the bird man, who transcends to the spirit world, found all around the world. The river of transformation, which of course in biblical times, but we find that around the world as well. In among the dreams of man, the two most common are the cosmic mountain and the water of transformation. So they're in our collective unconscious.
Right. Okay, well, that's going to do it for us tonight. Another fantastic program. Bernie, thank you so much for being here again.
Absolutely. Love to come back again.
And once again, it's beforeorion.com. Any other place you'd like to send folks to get more information about your work or your books?
Oh, well, Before Orion, I use on Reddit and YouTube and Instagram and Twitter, across the social media platforms. Follow me, like it, pass it on. And, you know, it's just, you know, keep the ball rolling. It's just a lot of fun to do.
All right. Terrific. We'll have you back again for certain. It's Bernie Taylor again, beforeorion.com. All right, let's see here. We've got a great show lined up for you tomorrow. Heather Ash Amaro will be here to talk about her book, A Little Book on Big Freedom. And then Wednesday night, it's Tanya Richardson, who is an intuitive, with her book, Angel Intuition, A Psychic's Guide to the Language of Angels. And then if we look ahead into Thursday night's program, Dr. Bruce Solheim, a returning guest to the program, also a distinguished professor of history, an author, and a psychic medium. He's got a new book out in his book series called Timeless Deja Vu, A Paranormal Personal History. And this book provides 31 additional accounts of true personal paranormal stories, including topics such as ghosts, telepathy, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, aliens, premonition. When we had Bruce on before, we said there are some people in this world that are just lightning rods for paranormal activity, and Dr. Bruce Solheim is one of them. I think this is the third book, if I'm not mistaken, in the series of books. It's second or third. I'm not exactly sure. I'll have to check on that. But it's a great conversation, and Dr. Bruce Solheim is a great guest, so we're looking forward to that. In the meantime, stop by the Facebook page, Beyond Reality Radio. Also stop by my Facebook page, JV Johnson. And if you haven't found the YouTube channel yet, you should do that too. Go to YouTube and just search JV Johnson. You'll find it there. Have a great night, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. It's Beyond Reality Radio.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by J.V. Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y, at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.